Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 14. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Tudor music is Brooke Little. Brooke is a PhD student, writer, and music instructor living in the United States with her husband and two cats. She graduated in 2001 with a Bachelor of Music in Vocal Performance and in 2008 with a Master of Music Education from the University of Missouri-Columbia. She has recently completed her second master's degree in musicology from the Conservatory at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Her master's thesis, entitled The Musical Lives of Henry VIII's Six Wives, was completed in December 2017. Brooke has conducted research at the Royal College of Music in London, Lambeth Palace Library, the British Library, and the National Archives at Kew. She presented her work on Jane Seymour and Anne of Cleves at the 16th Century Society Conference in Milwaukee in October 2017. She plans to continue her study of Tudor women's musical lives through doctoral study at Northwestern University. Brooke is committed to retelling the story of each queen through the perspective of their coronation performance, individual musical involvement, and contribution. My conversation with Brooke straight after this short musical break, courtesy of my very talented guest, Brooke Little. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Brooke. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, please?
Hi, Natalie. It's so great to be here, and I'm excited to get to talk to you today. Just a little bit about my background. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and I got an undergraduate degree in voice performance, so I studied music. And then I went back to school again and got a master's degree in music education, after which time I spent about 7 years teaching choir in various schools around Kansas City. From there, I went and decided to pursue a second master's degree in musicology, where I really honed in on some of my Tudor studies, and during which time I also ran a private studio. So I taught about 40 students for that time. And currently, I'm a first-year PhD student at Northwestern University. So
Fantastic.
A PhD adventure.
Yeah, gosh, that's yes. A big adventure, that one. Fabulous. And so what sparked your interest in the Tudors?
Honestly, for me, I think it may have started back in high school. My high school choir teacher had us perform Pastime with Good Company.
Yes.
And we ended up performing it at the local Renaissance Festival, complete with costume.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but from there, it really geared up a lot more seriously about 10 years ago when the show The Tudors was on.
Yes.
It started out as just kind of a guilty pleasure thing.
Yeah.
But it really sparked my curiosity. And so I just started reading. I had all these questions, what's true, what's not. And then especially musically, I just wanted to kind of just dig into it. So the first biography I read was Alison Weir's Six Wives of Henry VIII, which led me to Eric Ives' biography on Anne Boleyn. And like I said, I ended up going back to school for a second master's degree in musicology because I wanted to study.
Yeah, fantastic.
So
amazing. And so just something interesting that you said there about having watched The Tudors and then that having sparked your interest in The Tudors, and then you actually went out and looked at some actual nonfiction books and now you're doing a PhD. So that's interesting because obviously a lot of people get very upset when shows like The Tudors, you know, change history or that sort of thing, or it's not completely accurate. But I think that's a really good example of why they are great, because they bring obviously new readers and new people interested in the subject.
Right. Definitely.
Yeah. So that's great. So you completed your master's thesis and it's entitled The Musical Lives of Henry VIII's Six Wives. That was last December. I'd love it if you could talk to us a little bit about the musical upbringing of Henry's queen consorts, maybe highlighting, you know, any similarities or any major differences between their upbringing.
Right. So originally my thesis started out as I was just going to be studying Anne Boleyn.
Right.
And I spent some time in London at the British Library with some varying 16th century manuscripts, and I got to spend the day with Catherine of Aragon's songbook.
Yes, wonderful.
And it just completely changed, honestly, my research life. And I really started considering each individual queen and kind of the contributions that she made to the Tudor court, both culturally and musically. And so it just really sparked this interest in all of them, really. But Catherine of Aragon, I would say of all the six wives, Catherine probably had the most extensive music education.
Okay.
She was taught to sing Castilian antiphons, dance, and she had a fairly broad instrumental education. Mm-hmm. So she did learn to play kind of those typical 16th century instruments for females, so like lute and virginals. But she also had a really interesting instrumental education in that she was taught to play the monochord.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's an instrument that sounds a bit like a didgeridoo.
Right, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, and it has only one string. Yeah, it's a humongous instrument. The clava organ of Fiwela, and she even had a bit of an education on some percussion instruments. There was a little instrument called the cajitas, which is the early form of the maracas.
Okay.
Yeah, so Catherine's really very interesting because she grew up surrounded by a very musical court. Her father was known to walk into choir rehearsals and critique the singers' sound. So she kind of grew up surrounded by all of these different things. Her brother Juan had a very extensive music instrument collection, and it was said that he had the first clava organ ever to arrive in Spain. So it was
That's fascinating.
Yeah, she definitely, of all six of them, was, again, most well-prepared to kind of transition to the musical role as a married woman and a patroness. So she knew how to listen, and she knew exactly how to kind of be the hostess of the court. She knew exactly what to do just because she had that preparation.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah,
very interesting. I mean, and Anne Boleyn, I mean, what can we say about her, right?
Yeah, lots to say about Anne, always.
Yes. I think one of my very favorite quotes about Anne's musicality comes from the French ambassador Chateaubriand, and he said something along the lines of,
yep,
she possessed a great talent for poetry, and when she sung, like a second Orpheus, wow, she would have made bears and wolves attentive.
Oh, what a fantastic quote. I don't know if I've heard that one before, actually. I'm trying to think. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. He goes on to say, she likewise danced the English dances, leaping and jumping with infinite grace and agility. And moreover, she invented many new fixtures and steps, which are yet to know by name. So he really kind of paints a picture of her commanding the animals with her ability, which is, I just think it's so interesting, you know, now whether that's a bit of fairy dust sprinkled in there.
Yeah.
I mean, sure it is. So,
Oh, yeah.
But Anne, she's definitely the queen who has the most documentary residue left over of her musical life.
Okay.
So all of the sources, they're are more sources of her involved with music than probably any of the other six. So we can kind of gather information based on those things. It's just a bit easier, honestly.
Right. Okay.
Jane, I laugh because she's the queen about whom the least is known, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, and she reigned for such a short time, but I mean, musically speaking, I would guess that, again, she's educated at home. She has a family chaplain. The Seymours are a Catholic family. So Jane's relationship to music would probably best be defined as a music listener more than anything else. There's no real sources pointing to her as a performer or as even a patroness, unlike Catherine and Anne. There is a entry in the 1542 Whitehall Palace inventory where there's a pair of regals that once belonged to her that remained in the palace even after her death. So right. She owned instruments. So that's about her.
Okay.
Anne of Cleves, I think she's also really interesting.
She's fascinating. Yeah, she is.
She's so interesting. The German ambassador, Watton, he once said of her that Anne could not sing or play any instrument.
Right.
Before they take it here in Germany for a rebuke and in a case of lightness that great ladies should be learned or have any knowledge of music. So Anne, coming from this perspective of having no musical education at all. And then she comes to England, where that is pretty standard for many of the English women of the court. And it's not until after her divorce from Henry that she kind of starts to kind of explore that for herself. I love the image of her and Catherine Howard dancing at the New Year's Eve. Ball. It's kind of like she's reinvented herself as this sophisticated cosmopolitan English woman and this kind of provincial German princess with no knowledge of music at all. So
yeah, it's really interesting because she was really eager to learn and to please. Like even on her way over to England, there's lots of sources that say she was asking people, please teach me this card game, teach me how to, you know, she really wanted to please Henry and she wanted to do the right thing. So yeah, that is interesting that after her divorce, she kind of like goes, yeah, I'm going to, you know, do whatever I like now and learn what I'd like to learn.
I'm going to have a good time. I'm going to learn instruments and all of it. So very interesting. Catherine Howard, I think there's two main things that kind of classify her music education. First is kind of the way she receives that music education. So the Dowager Duchess singles out Catherine specifically to receive this music education that's going to put her in a position where she will be able to gain a position at court.
Mm-hmm.
So she gets private instruction on the virginals with the very infamous Henry Mannix.
Yes, Henry Mannix.
And then that comes back to, as we know, kind of haunt her in the end. What's interesting about that kind of relationship is that, and something kind of new I learned through my thesis is that, music instructors were hired in tandem. So Henry Mannix is actually hired with a man named Barnes. I don't know his first name. So that kind of goes against the idea that they were alone all the time. So she kind of, we don't know exactly what happened, but it is possible that this guy Barnes was with them for quite a bit at the time.
Right.
While she's receiving this private music instruction. Okay. Yeah.
So was that normal to have two sort of tutors at the lessons?
This was different. I had never heard of there being two, but right, for this one was two. So
that's interesting. I wonder why they decided to have two.
Yeah, Barnes actually is one person who contributes during the criminal investigations as a witness. So it's very curious.
That is a bit curious, yeah.
Yeah, and then Catherine Howard is the one who I think is I just think of her as the dancing queen.
Yeah.
I think it's very poignant that in the end, when she's confined to her apartments, that what she says when the musicians come by to play for her and practice dancing is that she says, now is not the time for dance. And I just, very reflective of the things that were important to her. Mm-hmm. And she loved it. She loved dancing.
Mm. Yeah.
She's the dancing queen.
Yeah, that's a tragic story, that one, isn't it? Like so many other Tudor stories, but that is particularly tragic, that one.
It is. Catherine, she's very, I don't know, it's easy to see her kind of through this 21st century lens of consent and those kind of things. And so I myself have to be careful of just trying to see the documents for what they are instead of putting my own feminist spin on.
It's not easy to do, is it? To do that.
But Catherine Parr, also just another super fascinating story. Her mother, Maud, was a lady-in-waiting to Catherine of Aragon. So Catherine Parr ended up having a very similar music education to Mary. So she also was educated in lute and the virginals and in singing and dancing. But what I think sticks with me about Catherine Parr, about her queenship, is just she really uses music as a way to kind of build her image.
Mm-hmm.
She creates this kind of cult of majesty almost. She has some Venetian minstrels that actually just follow her around.
Oh, wow. It's amazing.
They just follow her around just to declare her glory. So it's awesome. She knew how to make an entrance.
That is awesome. I love that.
Yes.
Fabulous. So what I know, the music obviously played a very important role, but so what exactly, how did we see music at the Tudor royal court? In what ways was it important?
I mean, this probably goes without saying, but music was absolutely central in the life of the Tudor court. We have to think of the fact that this was a time where there's no forms of recorded music, there's no television. So all of the music at court was a live performance. Everything had live players. So there was a musical presence at nearly every occasion you could think of. Henry had and kept a large trumpet retinue for his many outdoor appearances. There were ensembles for court dancing. There was the chapel choir. Mm-hmm. There were even musicians employed to play while Henry was entertaining women in his private apartments.
Right.
So music had many, many different functions at court. Music served as a way, especially for Henry, to showcase his majesty and his prestige. It's kind of like the idea of keeping up the Joneses between kings. So each court wants to have the absolute best musicians and the most. Like, I can just picture Francis and Henry having an argument about who has the best song player.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. And so can you go into a little bit more the role that music played at Anne Boleyn's coronation or Catherine of Aragon's coronation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Honestly, discussing and kind of comparing the two coronations for me feels like comparing the difference between, say, a Honda Civic and like a Rolls Royce.
Right. Okay.
So we have very little musical information about Catherine of Aragon's coronation.
Okay.
She was duly coronated with Henry, mm-hmm. and Hall's Chronicle mentions in about two pages the events of the entire coronation, mm-hmm. and kind of throws in there that the trumpets blew.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But the details for Anne's coronation in Hall's Chronicle goes on for 8 full pages.
Fabulous.
Details the pageants, the trumpets, the instruments that were on the barges that escorted Anne to the tower, and the singers singing Te Deums. And, I mean, I could just go on and on. I mean, I myself have seen Nicholas Udall's original verses and ditties that he composed especially for the occasion.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's also Wink into Words' recollection of the day.
Yep.
So, like we kind of talked about before, quite frankly, there's just more existing documents that point to coronation rather than Catherine's. Catherine's coronation music, and even the coronation itself, is kind of a footnote of history, whereas Anne's is, in my view, kind of an intentional display of Henry's rule.
Yeah.
I think that Henry is making a very conscious choice to make Anne's coronation even more fabulous than Catherine's. And one main way he does this is through multiplying the numbers of musicians he used, as well as ensuring that there's a greater variety of music used at every stage of the procession. I mean, Henry even had the onion domes mounted on the tower, posts for Anne's coronation.
Yeah.
So he's basically saying to the people, this is what I'm going to do, deal with it.
Yeah, that's right. So he did. He went above and beyond, didn't he, just to prove a point. So all the royal Tudor children were tutored in music. What kinds of instruments would they have learned to play?
So all three of the king's children would have been instructed by the Flemish singing master, Philip van der Wilder, who was a Dutch lutenist, and he was actually given the title Master of His Highness's Singing Children.
Right, okay. That's a bit of a mouthful.
It's a very, very important title.
Okay.
Mary and Elizabeth would have had a pretty similar music education, although Mary would have had her mother present, and obviously Elizabeth did not. Both of the women would have been educated in lute, virginal, singing, and dancing. Mm-hmm. Mary was said to have excelled at lute playing. And there's even some musical iconography where Elizabeth is actually playing the lute. So we can kind of associate her person with lute playing. Edward, like his sisters, also would have received education in lute and virginals. But I would guess that he would have had additional instrumental education on some kind of woodwind instrument.
Okay.
It was more socially acceptable for male students to be educated in the specific instrument family of woodwinds, whereas for women it was seen as really inappropriate.
Right, okay.
There were certain sexual connotations that went with women and playing any kind of wood instrument.
Right, I see, okay.
Yeah, and Edward's education is really unique as well because he's tutored by Christopher Tye, who in 1553 creates a songbook, The Acts of the Apostles, and has it to Edward, which is really special. I don't know, I think that's really cool. So.
All right, fabulous. Thank you. Now, let's talk about Henry VIII for a little bit here. I've heard differing sort of views on Henry's musical skills. So from what you've sort of discovered in your research, was he a particularly gifted musician?
You know, I have all these quotes of different people, different important men at court talking about how awesome Henry is at playing music. You know, and I have to ask myself if Henry wasn't king, you know, would this have been brought up, of course. But maybe it's kind of the if he was really bad at it, maybe they wouldn't have said anything at all. I don't know. So we have Sebastian Guastinian, keeper of the king's instruments. He says something along the lines of Henry played on almost every instrument, performing well on the lute and virginals. Raphael Holinshed, who was another court chronicler, noted Henry's very wide variety of musical activities, saying that he exercised himself daily in shooting, singing, dancing, and wrestling. And then he also talks about how he played the recorders, flute, virginals, and in setting of songs and making of ballads. So he's commenting on Henry's compositional skills. But like I said, I don't want to make a claim that I think he was good or not. I think that what I can say is that he was truly fascinated by music. I think of Henry as a musical instrument hoarder for sure.
He suddenly owned a lot of them, didn't he?
Right. At one point, he owned something like 78 different recorders.
Wow, that's a lot of recorders.
Just a couple of recorders. Some of them were bejeweled and gilded. So,
Wow, stunning.
yes.
Amazing. Now, Henry did write a number of compositions, I believe, but probably Pastime with Good Company, which you mentioned, is the most famous. He's also often credited with having written Greensleeves, but I'm pretty sure that that's of a later date. Is that right?
Right, that's right, Natalie. So, Greensleeves is one of those urban composition myths that musicologists have kind of trying been to debunk for years. He did not write Greensleeves. The tune is actually quite a common one that is found in several late 16th century and early 17th century sources. It comes from this manuscript called the Ballet's Lute Book. And actually, in the late 1580s, there are six or seven ballads that have a very similar name to Greensleeves that kind of pop up. So, yeah, he did not write
Yeah,
Greensleeves.
sorry, Henry.
Sorry, buddy. But he did write Pastime, maybe, or at least he's
Oh gosh,
credited.
I hope so. Yeah, I like that one too. That's really good. All right, thanks for clearing that one up. So, you've conducted research in some pretty awesome places, including at the Royal College of Music in London and at the Lambeth Palace Library. I was wondering if you could talk to us about some of the manuscripts that you've worked with during that time, maybe touching on what were some of the highlights for you, and whether you discovered anything that kind of surprised you.
Yeah, so going back to Catherine of Aragon, I did find an account of her coronation there, a very tiny manuscript through the eyes of a French onlooker, so through the eyes of somebody who's actually at her coronation. The document is about 6 pages long and very, very heavily water damaged. And obviously it's in French. So honestly, at some point I'm going to really master French paleography and go back and revisit it. But I
So is
was
that at
also
Lambeth? Was that at Lambeth or at the
that's Lambeth Palace.
Right,
Right. Also at Lambeth Palace Library, I did get to handle the Acts of the Apostles, one of the original Acts of the by with Christopher Tye, the songbook that he had dedicated to Edward. And
Wow.
it really struck me how, first of all, it's in English, and then second, that there are kind of, for me, it looked almost like an educational manual, like a religious education manual. So it's Bible stories kind of accompanied by song. So there's a song about the character of Ananias that was followed by a lesson in always telling the truth in the book, which I thought was really interesting. It was a very tiny, tiny little book. And just at the Royal College of Music, I did get to handle and spend the day with Anne Boleyn's songbook, which
Yes, how
was,
amazing.
oh my gosh, it was such a treat. I mean, I felt like I was meeting a celebrity just touching.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I was so struck by how small and unassuming the manuscript was. I really built up this image of it in my mind, and not in a bad way, mind you, was it surprising? It just was, there it was.
Yeah,
And
it's amazing. Gosh.
yeah, the page with her signature on it. It's such a tiny little inscription that says, Mistress Anne Boleyn, now thus.
Wow.
You wouldn't even know unless all these people had written about it.
Yeah.
But the small size of it really, I really pictured this manuscript as possibly being a focal point during domestic performances at court. It would have been perfect for, say, a trio of ladies in waiting to perform with.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it was very tiny.
Yeah, that would it. So they wouldn't have used it like that, or what do you think?
I think they could have, definitely. Yes,
Okay.
definitely.
All right.
Yes.
Oh, that's so exciting. I know there's nothing like holding something from the 16th century, is there? Especially something with Anne's signature. That's amazing. Now it's coming up to my favorite season time of the year, Christmas. So I wanted to know, and I love carols. I love playing carols. So what are some of your favorite 16th century carols?
Oh man,
You've probably got a lot, do you?
there's so many. I mean,
Yeah.
I love Adam Leigh and Bowden, although I have to say I love the Britain version from Ceremony of Carols. Honestly, that's one of my personal favorites.
Yeah.
A Boar's Head. I mean, can we
Yes.
talk about that song? It's so funny. We would never think now to go out hunting in the woods for a wild boar to
No.
bring for Christmas dinner. But it just is such a funny song. I also love the Branle de l'Official, kind of the Ding Dong Merrily on High
Okay.
carol. And Personnette Hodier. I actually ended up performing that with a choir group when I was in high school as well. But my absolute favorite is Coventry Carol.
Me too. Yes, I love it.
Yeah.
That's beautiful, isn't it? Well, maybe what we could do, because I'm thinking, me trying to write those names down, maybe you can send me a list and I can include it in the show notes for everyone. That might be really fantastic, because I think people like to go onto YouTube and see what they can find, which is normally what I do. All right, fabulous. Now it's our time to play 10 to go. So are you ready for 10 quick questions?
Yes.
All right, fabulous. So, because it is almost Christmas, I wanted to know maybe if you could share with us two or three kind of favorite Christmas traditions that you have.
I love making Christmas wassail every Christmas Eve.
Ah, okay.
So I do that, and then my family and I gather around the piano and we sing.
Oh,
Yeah, I play and we sing. We all sing together, and it's
that's
really
beautiful.
special. So,
Yeah, that's really lovely. I like that. What are two items that are on your bucket list?
we'll get my PhD.
Yes, that's a big one, isn't it?
Get my PhD, and there is a hotel or a manor in Kenya called the Giraffe House,
Oh, I think I've seen it. Yeah.
where you can go and the giraffes come up to the house and you can feed them.
Yeah.
On my list
On your
to
list.
spend one night there sometime in my life.
Sounds good. Now, what's something you
Yes.
do to recharge?
I binge watch documentaries.
Right.
Yes, that's my recharging. Or, yeah, I know it's very.
Any particular theme or just various topics?
I like the BBC ones, obviously, but I just enjoy watching documentaries on any subject, really.
Oh,
I just
that's good.
love, yeah, I love
Yeah.
learning, and for me, documentaries are an entertaining way to kind of garner information.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. Since you're a musical person, what's a song that kind of instantly lifts your mood?
I mean, I have to say Pastime.
All right, good. Yeah.
I have to say
I
Pastime.
like it. I like it.
It's, he wrote a nice little tune right there.
Yeah, it's
So
fabulous. Yeah, I agree. Apart from obviously music, and now we know documentaries, what's something else that kind of brings you joy?
I love spending time with my husband. I mean,
Oh,
he's
lovely.
yeah, he's the best, and we have two cats, and Spending time with my cats. Their names are Birthday and Mustache.
Oh, cute. I like that. Birthday
Black.
Mustache. Very
Yeah.
cute. All right. Name a favorite childhood book.
Favorite childhood book. I used to really love the American Girls series. I don't know if you're
Oh, okay.
familiar
No,
with
I
that
don't know
series.
this one.
So they have different characters of like 10-year-old girls that are set in different periods of history. So
Ah, that sounds cool.
yeah, so I and they have dolls, and
Oh, yes, I think
it's
I've seen the dolls. I think I've definitely seen the dolls, yeah.
the whole thing. But I had the Samantha doll, and so and she's set in 1904, so she's the
Oh.
Victorian one, and
Like it.
yeah, so I loved that series of books growing up.
Excellent.
Yes.
What's your favorite form of exercise?
Right now I'm doing Orange Theory,
Oh, I know.
which is a super intense heart rate based exercise.
Right.
So it's like a high intensity training. So you do part running, part weightlifting, part rowing, and it's kind of different every time you go to class, but I just
That sounds
that's my
really good.
yeah. Yes.
Excellent.
Definitely a mood booster. So
Yeah, great. What was the last thing you bought? Can you remember what the last thing you bought was?
I just bought new salad dishes,
Oh,
salad
nice.
because my cats knocked two off of the table and they broke, and so I
You can use them for your Thanksgiving. That's good for a bit of salad.
absolutely.
So another music-y kind of question. What's your go-to karaoke song? Do you do any karaoke?
Absolutely. So I'm going to probably embarrass myself greatly here, but my
That's
go-to karaoke song, I not to pat myself on the back or anything, but it's "Kiss by a Rose" by Seal.
Wow, that's a good one. I like that. I'm gonna record that one for us, I think. So, a bit of a big question, a bit philosophical here. What do you think is the secret to a happy life?
I think being a lifelong learner,
Yeah,
honestly. I
well, I
think
love that one.
being a curious person and never being content with just not exploring the world. I
Yeah.
mean, and that goes in with traveling and learning and meeting new people, all having new experiences, I think.
Yeah, that's
And
so true. I agree with you there. Yeah.
yeah.
Wonderment. It's so important to always maintain that sense of wow about this world, I think, which sometimes gets lost in the everyday kind of life. That's
Yes.
fabulous. Now, the last thing is our tutor takeaway. Do you have a tutor takeaway for our listeners?
I would just say to please purchase the 1542 inventory of Whitehall Palace
Oh,
with
okay. Excellent.
Constantly
Excellent.
by Maria Hayward. I think that first of all, it's a fabulous resource. I purchased mine on Amazon. And it's a such an awesome way to kind of get in depth with the everyday objects of the Tudor world. So you really get a sense of what are the things that surrounded at least the king, during this time in history. And we can kind of, from there, we can kind of imagine this trickle down effect with the items of the palace through to everyday Tudors. So I think
That
people
sounds,
should start.
yeah, that sounds fabulous. I have the 1547 inventory that was done after Henry's death, big, chunky, massive thing, which I love to look through because just like you say, the things that come up in there and you think, oh wow, these things are actually in the palaces. And also, I think fascinating to find things like I was particularly looking for things with Anne Boleyn's emblem on them after she'd passed away, just to see if there was anything left. And there were certain things still there and kind of put into storage here and there, and things, little dolls that I imagine Mary and Elizabeth playing with when they were young, and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's I agree, they're fantastic documents. If you love the Tudors, why not?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Brooke. It's been so lovely chatting with you today. And thank you for talking to me the night before Thanksgiving. I know you've probably got some cooking and all other things to get organized.
Yes, baking pies right now. But thank you so much for having me here. It's so good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. And I hope we can chat again in the future.
Right, that would be great.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.